So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Kurt Angle from the heart. Oh my God. And he got it again. Angle's got him. That's it. He's the champion. He's got it. Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Triangle choke. He's got the damn triangle choke on.
The triangle choke is locked in. Undertaker countered into a triangle
choke. He's got that choke on tight hold. Undertaker's got that in, man. Angle's trying to get out. He's going to get choked out. Angle's going to tag my tap out.
Kurt Angle may tap out for the first time in his career. The triangle choke is locked in, hey, here, ladies and gentlemen.
You know what? Kurt Angle might be out right now for all we know. Look at him. He's turned it purple, man.
Kurt Angle.
Kurt's going to tap. He's going to tap out Cole for the first time.
Look at the arm. Look at the arm.
He's going to tap. But he just didn't tap him.
Look at Kurt Angle's left arm. That's what you got to watch, ladies and gentlemen.
He's trying to hang on. Kurt's going to tap up top.
Referee in purple position.
That triangle. He's done. That triangle choke is done.
Kurt's going out. He's shaking. He's sick.
He's going out.
Kurt Angle's out.
One.
If the arm goes down three times, we have a new champion.
Two more, he's done. There's two.
There's two. We may have a new champion.
There we go,
baby.
There we go.
And Kurt Angle tapped it out.
He hung on.
Wait a minute. He rolls through.
He's got the choke on.
Look at this.
Triangle choke. Look at this.
Wait a minute. Kurt Angle pinned him. Kurt Angle pinned him.
Wait a minute.
Kurt Angle pinned him.
Oh, slow down. He didn't pin anything. Undertaker had that triangle choke on.
Yeah, but Kurt Angle pinned him. I believe the Undertaker's shoulders were down.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you for another week. And what a show we've got coming up, Wei.
Yeah, I know. Yes. Yes, it's going to be amazing.
We've got a guest coming up today on the program. It's not every day that we get to review the show and then chat with the lead writer at the time, with Alex Greenfield coming on to chat about No Way Out 2006.
Wow, that's very exciting.
So Alex will be joining us after the review, and we will ask him all about the goings-on, and I'm sure the Eddie Guerrero storyline will come up.
Perhaps, if he's okay to talk about it.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah, I'm sure he would be too.
Alex, he'll also be chatting about this new movie he has out called The Temple that people can watch, but we'll mention that later. But Wei, No Way Out 2006 from Baltimore, Maryland at the First Mariner Arena. I know you probably had watched this show back
when I was call screening for The Law.
Yeah, I never know. You were fairly regular at coming to watch pay-per-views, but not always.
I think I came every time, but I might not have shown up at the beginning of every show.
This was the month before we went to WrestleMania.
Ah, that's right. Yes. I might have watched this show. I don't recall it at all. So
it's one for the ages. Yeah. But an interesting show for sure. It was February 19th of 2006, and let's get right into things. The show starts off with an opening video of Ray dedicating his title win, hopefully at WrestleMania, to Eddie Guerrero, and Randy Orton has been put in his path to stop him from making good on this promise. And this was the infamous, Eddie isn't up there. Eddie's down there in hell. Probably one of the lines that I think every longtime wrestling fan remembers and probably cringes at when they hear. Uh-huh. I hated this storyline at the time. And going back to watch it, I hated it just as much rewatching it.
Yep. Even if you're a new wrestling fan, how could you find
how disgusting.
This? Yeah, this is very untasteful.
And then they preview the actual main event of the show, which is Kurt Angle against The Undertaker for the world title. And right off the bat, Michael Cole, Mr. Historian here, mentioning that this is the arena where superstar Billy Graham defeated Bruno Sammartino in 1977, where Tito Santana defeated Greg Valentine for the Intercontinental title in 1985, and it is where Vince McMahon defeated Stephanie 6 days before her wedding in an I Quit match between father and daughter. One of these doesn't fit.
Yeah, nice of him to remind us of such legendary matches.
Vince and Stephanie, which is in our review archive, everyone. No Mercy 2003.
Wow.
So you can go back, hear our thoughts about the first ever, first and only father-daughter I Quit match.
Mm-hmm.
Announcers here, Michael Cole and Taz. I thought this was the strong version of Michael Cole and Taz on this show.
Yes.
In fact, there is one match with Michael Cole that was just... I'll get more into it as we get into the descriptions. But we start things off with a cruiserweight title match with, I think, every cruiserweight on the SmackDown roster. We've got Gregory Helms defending the title against Scotty Too Hotty, Kid Cash, Nunzio, Psychosis, Brian Kendrick, Super Crazy, Paul London, and from Japan, Funaki.
Mm-hmm.
I think every nationalistic stereotype was present here. We had the Asian. We had the Mexicans who came out on John Deere lawnmowers.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Hick in Kid Cash. And we had Scotty Too Hotty making fun of white guys that think they're black.
Sure.
So yeah. Lots of...
And Nunzio, of course.
Nunzio!
Yeah.
What a multi-diverse opening match this was.
And we had Tatanka later on.
Oh, it was a great night. This was a tough match to follow because all the wrestlers were in at the same time, and it was whoever could score the first fall would win the match. Mm-hmm. So we had a 3-6-9-way match going
nine
on.
9-way, yes.
It's a round number.
No, it's fine.
If it's in Australia, it'd be 5. Helms runs away at the start as he's trying to save himself here in his title. The Mexicools, that being Psychosis and Super Crazy, work with London and Kendrick. They are sent to the floor and then take double planches. Kendrick misses a senton and lands on the back with a leg vine on him, and they roll through on him. Helms hits what used to be Mark Marrow's TKO onto Scotty to his knee, and then Psychosis misses Cash in the ropes, goes to the floor, takes a Hurricane Rana. We see Nunzio hit the Sicilian slice to London, but Kendrick makes the save. London and Kendrick then deliver double cross bodies off the top rope to the floor. Then Super Crazy goes for a suicide dive but is stopped by Helms. Helms misses the Shining Wizard. Kendrick then hits the sliced bread to Helms, but Super Crazy makes the save. London hits a senton to Helms, and then Scotty saves and super kicks London to the floor. This is where we see Scotty drop Helms and hits the worm, but Psychosis pulls Scotty out from winning the Cruiserweight title with the worm.
The worm, yes. And I should add, I watched this via what I could find online. Ever since the Mega video shut down, it's been
rough,
much tougher for us to try to grab these shows.
So mega effort every week.
Yeah, so I had to watch this on YouTube, and I saw the Spanish feed. So I was watching the Spanish commentary, and it's pretty cool, I have to say, seeing the Spanish announce team call the worm. Like, they sing like a song and everything.
Oh.
It's very different.
I want to hear this.
Mm.
The finish comes with Kid Cash going for a brainbuster to Psychosis, but then Super Crazy comes off the top with a moonsault to break it up. And then Helms, who's just basically lying there after being dropped by Scotty, rolls over to Psychosis and gets the pin at 9 minutes and 42 seconds. And then all the guys chase Helms to the back.
Yes.
You sneaky heel.
Mm-hmm.
As he runs off.
Yeah. I thought this match was awesome. It's everything you would expect from a cruiserweight opener. Non-stop, fast-paced action, high spots, and, you know, well done.
And Helms would actually keep this title for a year. Long run he had.
Long run, but usually that's indicative of how little people care about...
I don't think that's one of the title reigns people think of as one of the great runs in WWE history, even though it's one of the longest ever.
Yeah, it's longest, but we forgot about you, that's all.
And this was when he had shed the Hurricane gimmick and was just simply Gregory Helms.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
serious man.
Brilliant, brilliant marketing strategy.
Booker and Charmel are in the back with Teddy Long. Booker says he isn't 100% tonight, but Teddy says he looks 100%. And he looked 100% when he attacked Chris Benoit with a chair on SmackDown. And Charmel gets onto her knees and starts begging Teddy Long to not let Booker wrestle tonight. And Booker plays hurt as he gets onto a knee. And Long says either he wrestles tonight or he forfeits the title. And Booker, when he hears this, springs up and is just livid at Teddy Long's decision-making skills. So I thought Booker was rather funny here.
I didn't get to see any of these.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because I had to watch match by match.
See, I couldn't find it online anywhere, so I actually found this in my trunk. It was on a DVD in the packaging.
In your trunk?
Yeah.
Wow.
In the package.
You got lucky.
It's just a prize I hadn't given away.
You just find wrestling in all the little places in your life.
Some guy messaged me saying, hey, would you ever sell all of your wrestling stuff on eBay? It's like, that sounds stupid.
Why?
Because I'm sure I'm taking a net loss on whatever I sell it for.
Probably.
So why?
But you're taking a loss by having it in your house right now, taking up space.
It's in a storage unit. That would be just okay.
Well, what if you're
empty with stuff?
What if you have other things you want to store in there eventually?
We'll come to that, I guess, when we hit it. What am I going to get that needs storing?
I don't know.
I throw stuff out.
Clothing?
Clothing. If I need to put my clothes into a storage unit, I'll just get rid of the clothes.
What if you no longer have a storage unit?
But I do have a storage unit.
Yeah, but what if you move and you don't have one anymore?
If I move, I'm not going to move somewhere smaller. That would just be ridiculous. Okay. Why would I do that?
The point is, I can understand why people would sell their things on eBay, because it's taking up space. And
do people still use eBay? I never hear about eBay.
Are you kidding me? Of course they do. Why don't you go on eBay.com right now and see how many people have auctions?
I don't think it's all the rage as it used to be.
Okay, but nonetheless, people sell their used things when they don't need them.
What would the shipping be to send out hundreds of tapes?
I don't know. Not sure, but you can tell them individually.
I just saw this. I was like, what a hassle this would be. Why would I want to undertake just the annoyance of posting all this stuff,
yeah,
getting money on PayPal, shipping all of this stuff out?
Oh, there's no doubt it's a lot of work. But then
I'm going to have to search for some of this stuff because every website's going to get shut down and we're going to need these.
Yeah, I don't think you need to sell them because you actually have a use for your things. But for people that, you know, don't, I could see why they would, especially if they could fetch a
I make top dollar here at the Fight Network, so I don't need any side tape revenue coming in.
Okay. Would you sell them to a local? Somebody locally said, hey, John, I live in Toronto. I want to buy your wrestling things.
See, I don't get that logic at all because right now, present day, you can find anything. Let's be honest.
Some people like to hold it. Some people like to hold the actual DVDs.
No. I'm just, to me, it's just such a headache selling shit. What if I meet up with somebody?
I came to you and I said, John, I'm going to pay you $500 for all of your wrestling tapes and DVDs.
You are the last person that would spend $500 on wrestling
tapes.
No doubt
I am. But saying in an alternate reality, if I was a huge, huge collector, you wouldn't do it.
It would have to be a hell of an offer.
$500.
$500, come on.
That's plenty.
I probably spent that in 2003 for half of these fucking tapes.
And you've already got your worth out of these items. Now they're worth zero to you.
To me? I don't see that. I've spent X amount.
What are you doing with the No Way Out DVD from 2006?
Well, I didn't buy that one. That was just sent to us for free.
Well, let's say you did buy it. Now it's just sitting in your room.
Maybe
in your trunk.
Maybe we'll need it down the road. Maybe something will be so important.
You sound like my mom, who just like keeps everything.
I'm a hoarder.
Yeah. A hoarder.
But maybe that's what I'm waiting for. The big offer from hoarders to come on.
You're the wrestling hoarder.
Not only does this guy own 500 wrestling tapes, he talks about every tape each week on a podcast. Think of the promo we'd get from that.
Yeah, and your wife and kids would leave you.
That was my idea to do a commercial for Review Away. We were going to go to that, get like a white psych and stack up every tape we have to do a promo for Review Away. It'd be a great visual.
It would be.
We just have to get all this shit to where we shoot this. Maybe we could do a promo from my storage unit.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
That's where it would come
in. It is pretty insane when you open it, and it's just fucking tapes and tapes and DVDs and tapes and CDs. I just put all my shit down there.
You should take a photo of this, actually.
Just before we get back to this, one thing that's driving me nuts right now is, when we went to Ryerson, we learned how to edit on Vegas in first year for audio.
Yeah.
And I love this program. I've used it ever since 2003. I've been using this. And when I came to the Fight Network, I said, listen, I need an audio editing software. can you guys buy me this program? And they were like, yeah, no problem. It was like $150. I got the CD, and it's great. And I've been using this program now for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you've seen my old laptop. It's a piece of shit.
Yes.
So I need to, I'm trying to convert everything onto this computer now. I've put all my iTunes stuff on this. Everything is on this new laptop except for Vegas because I cannot find the fucking CD for it.
Okay.
And the new version, you see with Vegas, they've upgraded it so much that the video editing within it is the main draw for a lot of people. Mm. And it's like $900.
Really?
There's no way I'm getting a wow. $900 program.
That's
for audio editing.
That's really expensive.
So I've torn apart my storage looking for this fucking CD to load onto my new computer, and I can't find it anywhere.
You would be using, though, like a 5-year-old version.
Vegas 4.0 is what I edit on.
Hmm.
It's probably, there's probably like audio people out there who are like, ha, what an idiot.
Why don't you try another program?
I really hate having to learn new programs. Like our former employee Brad put this program called Sonar onto my new laptop. This thing is just like I've tried, and it's just
really?
Like a really complex program. That
what about what do they use at TSN or the Score? They used to use like Audacity, right?
Or Audacity sucks. I'm not a big fan of Audacity.
Audition?
Audition is okay. Audition I have on my old computer, but it's the same problem. It's a slow fucking laptop. Like, it's just, it sucks for it to run anything.
You don't have the disk? You don't have the installer for Audition?
Audition,
do you have the license at least?
You know, I probably do have the Audition CD somewhere. You're right.
Okay. There you go. Problem solved.
So that could be it. That is Way's, segue to, okay, shut the fuck up. Crying tears for me here. Booker and Charmel did their segment, and now we're moving on. Crystal Marshall, the Bobby Lashley's ex-wife, is in the back, and she's talking. Finlay walks in.
Hey, why don't you think that worked out? Why did they break up?
Because he gassed against John Ott on Titan FC.
No, seriously.
I don't know.
Well,
how would I know?
At what point did they divorce?
It was like a year ago, I think, they separated.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
It's just sad.
They met in wrestling, and they broke up in MMA.
Yeah, I know. It usually doesn't...
It's the opposite, usually. Usually wrestling is the killer for marriages. But they were on the road together.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they still met through wrestling, and it's just... That usually doesn't work out quite often.
Would you be able to last traveling with, like, your significant other on the road every week for wrestling?
Oh.
Like, what a grind.
Yeah, but I could imagine the insecurity of not traveling with them. You know?
Crazy. Relationships are not designed for this business.
No, really not.
So, Crystal Marshall, Finlay walks in, says he came all the way from Ireland for a fight tonight. He was very presumptuous.
That's a long flight.
It's a long flight.
Yeah.
Says he doesn't have one, so he's going to have to pick a fight. And he lifts up Crystal and walks out to the ring, presumably to fight Crystal. And comes into the ring with Crystal, teases, I don't know, attacking her.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bobby Lashley runs out to the rescue. Art imitating life.
What do you mean?
And Bobby Lashley coming to Crystal's aid.
Were they not together at this time?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know what their Facebook status was at this time. They fight. And then JBL comes out in a limo to try and capitalize on Bobby Lashley being worn down by Finlay. And that just segues into our next match, which is Bobby Lashley against JBL, who had the mole-faced Jillian Hall in his corner at this time as his assistant.
It wasn't really a mole. It was like a,
it was a
fetus.
Yeah, it was some growth. It was really gross.
Yeah.
Dumb gimmick. But then we've got Natalia's new gimmick. You seen this?
No, I haven't actually. I didn't watch.
Well,
SmackDown.
Apparently we missed it last week on Raw because I think they did it, but I don't remember it. So on SmackDown, her and Beth are in the back doing squats, and she farts.
Oh God!
And
I heard about this.
She no-sells it, but Beth is like grossed out and walks off, and then Natalia leaves. She farts again, and then Santino walks in and he's like dying. Similar to what Natalia's career is doing right now. What a That to me is like one of the worst ideas I've ever seen get greenlit, even by WWE standards. Like, it's, this girl's going to fart. That's her gimmick. Someone came up with that. Someone that is paid a salary to come up with storylines decided, let's have this girl fart. This is really going to get her over to the casual fan.
I really don't think that's what this is about. To me, this is akin to bullying on a main stage. This is them saying, you're going to do what we tell you to do, and what we want you to do is to play a girl who farts. We're going to humiliate you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
You know what I think happens, and this is my psychoanalysis of Vince McMahon, is that every once in a while, he pops in Wrestling with Shadows, and I think he watches that. Mm-hmm. And I think by the end of it, no matter how good he's made up with Brett, he gets angry because of that fucking scene where he's showing limping out, the scene he wanted cut from Wrestling with Shadows. Uh-huh. And I think he watches it, and he just is seething over this documentary and the access we gave these guys. And he remembers Diana Hart saying, we were bullied in school and people would call our dad a fake and they'd call us Hart Fart. And I think that's where this came from. Diana Hart being called a Hart Fart. And Vince said, God damn it. She's gonna fart. She's gonna fart.
Oh, boy. Well,
makes about as much sense as anything.
That does.
How do you come up with this? How does a round table of writers, maybe we'll ask Alex this. Yeah. How do these ideas, how does anyone have the balls to even, like, I would feel stupid suggesting this. Like, I would worry about my job security when these are the ideas I'm coming up with in exchange for money. Real money is being paid. Let's have her fart. Huh. Yeah, let's do it. It's a great idea.
That's terrible. Maybe it's leading to something, though. Maybe she's, I don't know. Maybe she farts on...
Maybe that'll be her new finish? She'll do the sharpshooter and fart on them. And it'll knock them out cold.
Okay. Yeah.
These are the kind of ideas... Wait, we'd be, like, promoted to, like... run SmackDown if we were thinking about this. I mean, they already listen to the show, so really,
it's
don't hesitate, guys, just contact us.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. She farts and maybe it'll get over, you know. Well, look at what we all thought about Brodus Clay when he first debuted.
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned when that gimmick started, I think there's a certain shelf life to it, but he's awesome. I think he's fantastic.
How are they going to mimic the fart live to a live crowd? That's what I want.
You think they do a sound effect in the arena?
That would be so bad. So terrible.
At what point do you just, like, hunch over if you're Natalia and be like, this isn't worth it. This is not worth it. I'm cutting down that 135 and I'm going to fight Ronda Rousey.
I imagine they're promising her some type of payoff. You know, like, well, you do this for us.
This is the kind of gimmick. She's always going to be remembered as the girl that farts. Uh-huh. That's going to be her label in this business. Mm-hmm. This is going to be horrendous to overcome. I don't even know if it can be overcome. How are you ever going to take this? To me, is right akin to Mark Henry and what he had to overcome.
With the hand, absolutely.
Oh, God. So Jillian Hall had a fetus growing off her face, which eventually got eaten by the boogeyman. And we still watch wrestling to this day. Finlay is sent backstage. JBL is selling, heads to the floor. Lashley gets hit in the back with a clipboard by Jillian. And then hits a belly-to-belly suplex to JBL on the floor. And a few months later, this man had to retire due to back injuries. I think one did lead to the other. Lashley goes for a vertical suplex. Struggled and almost lost JBL here. Cutting it very close, but finished it okay. JBL responds, sending Lashley to the floor, and then a boot on the apron by JBL, and he wears down Lashley with a sleeper. Doesn't really have the crowd too much into this match. Lashley was very, very green at this point. I mean, he was called up really early in 2005. Lashley makes a comeback with a series of belly-to-belly suplexes with four altogether. JBL gets busted open at some point above his right eye here. Looked really nasty. Lashley goes for the Dominator. It's countered, but then Lashley hits a T-bone for a two count. And then Finlay comes back. throws Tony Chimmel into the ring, and this allows the referee, Nick Patrick, to be distracted by Chimmel being thrown into the ring, and meanwhile, Finlay, behind the ref's back, hits Lashley with the shillelagh, and JBL pins Bobby Lashley, ending his unbeaten streak, 10 minutes and 57 seconds. Not a fantastic match.
No, I thought it was pretty boring up until the finish. The finish was done well, but most of the match, not great.
I think JBL was really hurting at this point, and Lashley needed to be carried, and thus pairing him with Finlay was a smart move, I thought.
I wonder why the decision to end the streak in this match.
You know, I know there's examples. Everyone points to Goldberg, but I think the winning streak is... It can also be a bit of a curse, you know, because eventually the guy's got to lose. You're limited in what you can do with him and booking him, and then once he loses... It's really a difficult period. Like, Goldberg, after that loss to Nash, he really floundered for a while, and he never got back to that same level. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was some shitty booking attached to that as well. But I think, you know, with Crimson, I think it's best, like, they've kind of just dropped it. And I think maybe that's best, and not put such a emphasis on it when he's not a guy you're even focusing on too heavily.
I guess I just felt like they, you know, he did have a streak going, and they could have made a bigger deal out of the match. But I suppose this was it. They decided to cash in here.
Got a WrestleMania 22 promo with Big Time by Peter Gabriel. My favorite WrestleMania theme of all time.
Yeah.
Batista comes out. He had been injured at the time. Comes out in a suit. Gets into the ring and says, "Yeah! Thrill of a lifetime every time I walk out." Cutting a Batista promo. He says he's here for three reasons. He wants to see the main event tonight between Kurt Angle and The Undertaker. He misses the SmackDown fans. And the third reason is his torn tricep. It isn't torn anymore. And sooner rather than later, he will be back. And whoever is champion will be beat. And they go backstage. Randy Orton is upset at Batista, thinking he's just going to walk back and become champion. And Kurt Angle is standing there with Orton. And Orton says he's going to be the champion. And who does Angle even think he is? And he says, "I'm Kurt Angle." But he blows off Orton, saying, "I'm focused on The Undertaker tonight." Then we get, I don't know if you got to see this, a WWE.com segment of WWE Instant Access, where they just showed Josh Matthews interviewing JBL and Jillian, and JBL's cutting this crazy promo that no one can hear, and Josh Matthews is doing the interview as David Lagana is transcribing the interview on screen, typing on his laptop. David Lagana getting some FaceTime here on the pay-per-view.
Did not get to see this. So what was this? Was this out of character?
No, it was in character, but JBL, you could just tell he's cutting this crazy promo, and it's being transcribed. It's like you're losing this whole promo. Like, just shut up. Let's hear JBL cut a promo.
Huh. I see. Interesting.
Kind of strange. Next, we've got an open challenge by the tag champions Eminem for a non-title match.
Sure, why not?
Got me at the edge of my seat. Mm-hmm. Non-title open challenge. So they come out with Melina, and then they take on the dynamic duo of Matt Hardy and Tatanka.
Uh-huh. Matt Hardy could have chosen anybody in the locker room. Decided to choose
the Indian. The Native American, Tatanka.
Native American, yes.
I'm sorry.
And I wonder why. Tatanka, of course, was on his last run here in the WWE.
From North Carolina.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so Tatanka returned, of course, at the Rumble that year, and he looked in really good shape at that time, so this is an extended stay for him.
Yes, Tatanka. He had done that match, too, like a year prior with Kurt Angle, where he looked great, and then suddenly people realized, oh, he was in there with Kurt Angle, wasn't he? an odd team here. We got to ask Alex about this story, that Tatanka apparently... He said this on Lagana's podcast, that he had all these storyline ideas of what he could do, and he presented it to the writing team on a big floppy disk. Gave him the floppy disk. We'll find out if that story was true and what happened to this floppy disk and what Tatanka's ideas were. I want to get inside Tatanka's head. The man, even to this day, I mean, he's still working indies and stuff and wants to go. He's not going out there for 6 minutes and doing his spot. He wants to go 30 every night.
Is he on Twitter? Can he Twitter on his Apple too?
I think he's on Twitter.
He is, huh? Wow.
Matt Hardy is selling early on, gets draped on the ropes, slapped by Melina, and he makes the tag to Tatanka, who comes in with a tomahawk's chop to both members of M&M. M&M then gets the heat. They isolate Tatanka in their corner. Tatanka makes the hot tag to Matt, hits a tilt-a-whirl side slam to Mercury, and then the Bulldog clothesline combo to both. Side effect to Nitro. Then Mercury blocks the Twist of Fate, and Nitro hits a super kick. Hardy comes back with a double clothesline, tags Tatanka, who hits double chop off the top rope. And it ends with Hardy hitting a swinging neckbreaker to Nitro right at the same time as Tatanka hits a Samoan drop to Mercury. And Tatanka pins Joey Mercury 10 minutes and 27 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his team successful in their first outing.
Yeah, totally. It was nice to see Tatanka get this, but a very average match. I really thought...
Did some tag spots.
Yeah.
We're good.
I thought what really stood out for me, though, was Melina. I thought she was fantastic at this time.
She yelled a lot.
Well, she was the star of this team in terms of charisma and just attention.
And with Matt Hardy at this time, he was kind of just... He was moved over to SmackDown after the Edge feud, and this guy like consistently just had these great matches during this whole time period, and just kind of... This was his fate. I was okay, you're going to team with Tatanka now.
This is his Twist of Fate.
Thanks, guys. Oh, very nice. Another WrestleMania promo, and Cole comes back, and he's just joking around with Taz, saying, everyone loves Taz when you say, oh, my God. And Taz just, like, shrugs his shoulders and calls Cole an idiot. It's just this weird interplay between the two. Then we get a video for the next match, Booker T and Chris Benoit, where Booker won the U.S. title after his substitute Randy Orton defeated Chris Benoit for the title after interference from Booker.
Mm-hmm.
A little confusing.
Oh, he was claiming a groin injury, and this is Booker taking the easy path to the title.
So Booker comes out and teases that he won't wrestle because he isn't healthy. Teddy Long comes out and says, well, then you will forfeit the title. And Booker goes to leave. Benoit is in the ring, and Benoit grabs the mic.
Actually, Booker said he would forfeit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's... Yeah, you're right, you're right. So Booker teases forfeiting the title and leaving when Benoit gets on the microphone and starts yelling, coward, coward, mm-hmm. coward, and says he won't accept the title by forfeit. And Charmel then comes over and starts yelling at Benoit, slaps him multiple times, and this leads to Booker attacking Benoit from behind, and the match begins for the United States title.
If you announce that you forfeit, isn't that official?
I guess until the announcer makes the ruling of what the outcome is.
So Booker was really gambling.
If you forfeit, I guess the match, you'd have to ring the bell. I don't know. How would this work? Like, from logic's point of view here, wouldn't you just start the match and then just run away and get counted out? Keep the title.
Well, then you lose a lot more pride by actually losing. Than forfeiting, you don't have to take a loss. It just says you couldn't compete. It doesn't matter.
Well, the match begins, and Booker has the advantage to start. Benoit hits a baseball slide to send Booker to the floor, and then gets thrown into the steps. But then he draws Benoit in, tosses him into the steps, and we get back in. Benoit is working for the crossface. Booker gets to his feet, lays out Benoit with a spin kick. Booker has a sleeper, which Taz calls a rear naked choke. And Benoit hits the Three Amigos for his comeback, gets a two count. They fight to the top. Benoit fights him off with headbutts and then a superplex to Booker with a two count as a result. Booker attempts the Harlem Hangover during this match but misses. I don't think anyone wanted to take this after the Rick Martel incident. But Booker busting out the Harlem Hangover here leads to three consecutive German suplexes by Benoit. Benoit then climbs to the top. Charmel gets on the apron, and Booker crotches Benoit, hits a scissors kick, but only gets a two count. Crowd pops big for that move. And then Booker goes for a rolling sunset flip, but Benoit rolls through, goes for the sharpshooter, does not fart on him. And then Charmel gets knocked off the apron here, so she can't interfere. Benoit puts the sharpshooter back on, pulls him into the center, and then transitions into the crossface to finally get the win. 18 minutes and 16 seconds these two went. Not the best match I've seen with these two, but I like the finishing sequence here with the transition into the crossface.
This was a very slow, decompressed type of matchup. But yeah, by the time the finish arrived, the crowd was really into it.
So Benoit goes to the back, and he's celebrating with The whole locker room out there. He gets, he sees Teddy Long and Matt Hardy. Tatanka gives him the thumbs up, and everyone's applauding him. And he ends it with Chavo and Vicky. And Rey Mysterio is standing there as well. Benoit tells him to beat Orton, and he's doing it for all of us, and you're doing it for Eddie. And this a good setup for the next match here with everyone, and there would be a stark contrast to this later on. So they go to the video of Orton and Mysterio. Mysterio winning the Rumble the prior month, eliminating Orton last, and then Orton challenges him for his Mania spot and tells Rey, you have as much chance of going to WrestleMania as Eddie does of coming back to life.
They seem very proud of these lines, so much so that they started to feature them in all these recaps.
I hated this so much. It just, I mean, a lot of people, when we did that most tasteless angle contest, this was at the top. You just felt so dirty as a wrestling fan. It's not like I felt Orton was this, I mean, he was a really great heel, but to me it was like,
he didn't need this.
No, he didn't need this, and this was... The heat was on the WWE. It's like, how can you be so exploitive here? Mm-hmm. It was like Randy Orton is being told to act like this.
Yeah.
It's not like this guy is cutting a promo that you feel is him at all. I hated this so much. Mm-hmm. It was just, yeah, we have the balls to do this, and you're going to like it. I hated every second of this angle. Terrible. It was just so disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Made me really question why I even watched this.
Made you think about selling your DVDs.
It got me to that point. Orton and Mysterio come out. Chance of Eddie to start the match, and it starts slow. Rey hits a bulldog, goes for the pin, being on the offensive at the start of this match. Orton was really great at playing the arrogant heel. He just, like, everyone heard the stories of what an asshole this guy was behind the scenes, and he really projected that. And I think that added to his heel aura. I mean, at one point, just spits at the crowd, like literally spits out towards the crowd. Just a really easy to hate character. Orton gets the advantage. He slaps him in the corner, is beating on Rey. Crowd was very anti-Randy here. Rey hits a tilt-a-whirl head scissors, which sends Orton to the floor. Goes for a hurricanrana off the apron, but is caught by Orton and swung into the post. And Taz is just disgusted at Randy Orton doing this. He says, Randy Orton is a son of a bitch. Taz was just having none of this.
Mm-hmm.
Orton gets the heat. He uses the San Martino-style backbreaker to drop Rey onto the left arm, which he starts working on. And Michael Cole is so concerned about the left arm here, saying, this will make it hard for Rey to drop the dime. What if he can't drop the dime? I love Michael Cole talking about dropping the dime.
That's the name of the move, you know?
How will he drop the dime? Orton stomps on the left arm, on the steps. He puts the arm around the bottom rope and is like working for like a key lock almost. There's a lot of MMA influence you saw on SmackDown at this time, both here and in the main event.
Sure.
You know, not a huge example here, but Taz at least was trying to incorporate it a lot throughout here and using traditional wrestling holds with like MMA vernacular.
Well, this is 06, right? Right as the Ultimate Fighter was popular and everything was booming. So
Rey hits an arm drag, sends Orton to the floor. Then Rey builds up his comeback, hits a toe hold into the corner. And then just out of nowhere, Cole says, well, that's not going to help Randy Orton's concussion. Like, what? And they explain, yeah, he got a concussion 9 nights ago on TV. And probably storyline concussion. I was like, why wouldn't you bring that up? That's a...
It's got a
bump on the head.
Yeah, it's nothing.
This is funny to see. It's like, here we are, like, 12 minutes into the match. It's like, well, that's not going to help that concussion he has. Orton goes for an electric chair on the second rope, but Rey counters with a powerbomb, gets a two count, hits a spinning kick, does the Eddie shuffle on his feet, and he takes out the knee and hits a springboard, and this legit busts open Orton's forehead here. Goes for a quebrada, gets caught by Orton, but Mysterio counters that, gets poked in the eye by Orton, and then Rey comes back with a dive off the top. It takes a drop kick from Randy Orton, and they play it up that Orton might have attacked that injured left arm of Rey. Ray then blocks an RKO, drop kicks Orton, who gets set up for the 619 position. But as Ray goes for the 619, Orton ducks, rolls up Ray, and he grabs the ropes for the win. 17 minutes and 28 seconds. So Randy Orton, theoretically here, has taken Rey Mysterio's WrestleMania title shot. Ray's facials were awesome here after. Like, he sold like he was going to cry here. Yeah. And the announcers just went silent. And as horrible as this storyline was, they played this up like this was horrendous.
I thought Ray and Orton both did a great job here. I thought Orton did a great job of looking like the monster, and Ray, maybe my favorite baby face that they have in the company.
He's such fantastic. A sympathetic baby face that this crowd was just in shock over the finish of. And Orton gets on the microphone and tells Ray that he's going to the main event of WrestleMania. Where are you going, Ray? And the announcers just sell how horrible this is, and Ray leaves upset that he let everyone down. They keep calling it tragic. And Taz, to show his display of seriousness, takes his glasses off because he's so despondent here. How could this happen? And they replay the finish. And even a tiny thing here was that as Orton rolled up Ray, the referee in this one, Jimmy Corderas, he angles himself so there's no way he can see the arm being grabbed. Like, he positions his body to look at the shoulder at an angle, which I'm sure was deliberate. And they show Ray coming backstage. He walks the same wrestlers who just stand around all night, apparently. They don't know what to say. They're looking down, and everyone's nervous and embarrassed for Ray. And he walks to Chavo and Vicky's crying, and Ray's apologizing. Chavo tells him to pick his chin up and gives Ray a hug as the locker room looks on, and Ray just leaves. And he walks down this long hallway with this low-angle shot where he's hitting the side of the hallway. Just a great shot.
Yeah, it was really good. I thought Ray was especially fantastic. His acting was very good. The Mexicals, not so good. Super crazy. Just
They go to console him, and Psychosis stops him. It's so awkward.
Everything they do is tongue-in-cheek and comedic, it seems. But I thought Ray was fantastic. Chavo, Vicky, they're all really good.
So then we preview the main event. The setup for this was that, as we mentioned, Batista was injured, had to vacate the world title. And they put up the title in a battle royal with Kurt Angle coming over from Raw to SmackDown to win the vacant title and calls himself the best in the world. And then at the end of the Royal Rumble, The Undertaker makes his return on a chariot. Horses bring him back. And it sets up the main event. Angle has this great soundbite where he says, "When the bell rings, I don't have a soul either."
Ooh,
ominous. So they played up the fact that neither man had ever tapped out, and that was the setup here. Kurt Angle against The Undertaker for the world title, main event of No Way Out. They come out. Cole says that both men, future Hall of Famers. You think we'll see Kurt Angle going to the Hall of Fame? Probably next year if he's still under contract at TNA. Could be. Early on, Undertaker's working over the left arm of Kurt. Kurt gets the advantage after Undertaker misses a boot in the corner and gets knocked off the apron. Angle gets caught jumping off the apron and driven into the post. And then we see a leg drop on the apron by Undertaker. There was a sign in the audience that said, "Congrats, Christian," who had just won the NWA title in TNA like a week or two prior. Angle hits these stomps to the left knee, then clips the left knee, and that would kind of be the story of the match, is working over this left leg throughout. He applies a figure four onto the post, the Bret Hart spot, applies an ankle lock on the floor before they get back into the ring, continues working on the leg. The Undertaker here applies a triangle choke, gets no reaction here, but the announcers sell it big. Angle eventually gets to the ropes, and then Taz explains how he's had the move applied to him and what it feels like. And when they first introduced this triangle, I mean, this was the case. No one reacted to it, but it got over to the point that it was used at WrestleMania with Edge, and it was the finish. So it took a long time. They fight to the floor. The Undertaker's on offense. They fight by the table. Angle puts Undertaker through the table with an angle slam, and they tease the count out, but Angle stops Nick Patrick at 9, saying he doesn't want to beat Undertaker that way. They get back into the ring. Undertaker climbs to the top, but is stopped as Angle hits a running suplex off the top. Angle counters a choke slam and rolls into the ankle lock. Undertaker breaks and gets the triangle back on, and Angle then rolls through back to the ankle lock. And it would be these continual offensive maneuvers that Taker would attempt, like the last ride or the choke slam, and Angle would counter them all and get back into the ankle lock, but Undertaker still would be able to work out. Angle then hit the angle slam, got a near fall. Crowd was just going nuts here when they got into the near falls and the near submissions. And I thought Michael Cole, this might have been the best match I've ever heard him call. He was so good in this match. Just really, at times, when you had just the severity of WrestleMania on the line here and a serious main event here, I thought Cole was great. Angle brings the straps down. Taker sits up. They do a series of counters with the tombstone, ending with another ankle lock, and then into the heel hook for the big pop. And Undertaker rolls over, kicks Angle in the face to break it. But then Kurt Angle, playing Fedor here to Undertaker's Fabricio Verdum, leans in on top right into the triangle. And he keeps his arm up at two, and then he bridges over to pin the Undertaker for the finish. And there was no music played at the end, and they disputed who had won the match. And they ruled it was Kurt Angle by pinfall. And the pay-per-view ends with Taker cornering him and saying, "I have your number, and I'm not done with you yet."
Just an excellent match.
It was great.
Really good. One of Taker's best. And I put it up there with any of Taker's best WrestleMania matches. I thought this was really good. The pinfall was a little anticlimactic due to...
They really played up the idea of tapping out. And I don't think it would have hurt Taker at all to have tapped here.
No. It would have been Angle who would have tapped.
I'm saying that had they gone with the heel hook spot to finish the match.
Oh, okay.
Rather than the pinfall. I kind of agreed with that. The finish was kind of... I think they didn't want to completely...
Bury Undertaker.
But I really... This match was so good, I didn't think it would have hurt either guy.
I don't think so either. To me, it just seemed like, you know, the pinfall was very obvious, and any attempt at creating any type of suspense wasn't really working. But nonetheless, just a fantastic match throughout.
Yeah, great, great main event. Orton and Ray... Very strong match as well, but I think the storyline really rubbed people the wrong way with that one. It's not... You think of that feud, you don't think of their in-ring work. You think of the promos.
I personally don't have an issue with them using, you know, Eddie Guerrero's memory as an inspiration for
sure.
Ray to grab the title.
Yeah.
But you don't need to throw in those lines about those terrible, tasteful, distasteful
lines. I think
you
would have had just as much heat, and not the bad kind of heat, by, you know, Ray saying, "I'm going to win this for Eddie," and Orton saying, "No, you're not. I'm going to win the world title, and I'll do anything to win that title."
Yeah.
You didn't have to cross that line. I don't think that's the kind of heat that translates to people being into a heel or wanting to buy a pay-per-view. If anything, I think it was a turnoff to people who just didn't want to support this this product.
Absolutely. I give this show an 8 out of 10, simply for the last two matches. They're really good. The opener was solid as well, and you know, there were really no duds besides maybe the Lashley match, but everything was pretty solid.
So I'll give this one a 6.5 out of 10. Last two matches were pretty strong. Main event was excellent. Kind of one of those underrated gems that maybe people don't think of when you think of, you know, Kurt Angle and Undertaker matches. They didn't work too much together. I mean, they did a few pay-per-views together, but this was the real classic the two had. So that was No Way Out 2006. We're now going to shift gears and welcome Alex Greenfield to the show. He was the lead writer for SmackDown at this point, and he will take us behind the scenes of what was going on with the SmackDown brand in 2006. Joining us now, the former lead writer of SmackDown to help us get into the world of No Way Out 2006. This guy was someone who liked to have long-term ideas and then work backwards towards those ideas. A real oddball in the world of the WWE. Alex Greenfield returning to the show. And how are you doing today, Alex?
I'm doing great, man. How are you guys?
Well, we're doing pretty well. Before we get into No Way Out, I want to chat a bit about The Temple, which you have just released. You co-wrote it, and you also have a bit of a cameo role in the movie. So tell us a bit about this project, because it's got kind of an interesting concept of how you guys kind of put the movie together.
No, I've been doing some work with Amazon Studios, which is Amazon.com's new movie division. I think we even talked about that over the summer when we spoke.
Yes.
And they ended up giving my writing partner, Mike Eidelman, and I their best script award and $20,000, which was pretty frickin' nice. And they gave us a $50,000 budget to do what they call a test movie. And I've been a comic book mark ever since I was a little kid. So I got in touch with one of my favorite artists, this three-time Eisner Award winning artist named Rich Kozlowski, who did like Weapon Omega for Marvel Comics. And we ended up doing a motion comic, and Amazon dug it a lot. And they ended up really getting into the movie. They put it up on their, not just their studios site, but the main Amazon Instant Video site. And people have been giving a good reaction to it. It's sort of, it's a movie about special forces soldiers in Afghanistan who stumble on, you strip it all away, stumble on what amounts to a haunted temple in the Badlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and face all kinds of Lovecraftian horrors. So we're pretty proud of it. We got a great cast. We have like Bobby Ray Schaefer from The Office and Darren Cooper from The X-Files. And yeah, if anybody wants to amuse themselves and watch it, I'd love them to. I think it'd be great. But all you got to do is go on video, plug in the temple, and it'll pop up and you can watch it for free.
Cool. I encourage everyone to go check that out. It's The Temple, that you can go to studios.amazon.com /movies/13729, and it's free. So that's great. You you're not fighting here with SOPA or anything like that.
You don't they're not even any drop in ads that you have to sit through at the top of it, which we like. We were worried that was gonna happen.
Well, this did give us a chance to kind of take a look back at No Way Out 2006 and have you on to kind of get a sort of behind the scenes perspective at this time period with the WWE heading into WrestleMania 22. And I wanted to start off with the top program on this show, and that was Kurt Angle defending the world title against The Undertaker. And this, to me, is one of those kind of forgotten gems, I think, over the past 10 years. I mean, this was just an incredible match here by Kurt Angle and The Undertaker.
Yeah, it was really great. I mean, the truth is, we sort of, as you probably remember, in the lead up to Kurt becoming our champion on SmackDown, it was sort of, we had a big program going, setting up for Mark Henry. We had this big sexual harassment angle going with Melina, and she brought in Mark Henry is sort of her enforcer, and he was beating the crap out of Dave, and we were setting up for that. And that's what we anticipated as our program sort of in the run up to Mania, originally planning on Dave and Randy working at WrestleMania. So that was sort of the interdictory program. Of course, Dave unfortunately got hurt, and we didn't have anybody in a championship position at that point. Vince made the call to bring in Kurt to be our champion, and we sort of needed something to keep us rolling. And Undertaker, obviously that program started at the Royal Rumble, and they really escalated. And what Undertaker and Kurt put together really in a very short period of time, I thought, you know, both this match and the follow-on match, I believe the next week on SmackDown, were just really well done. It's still a finish. I love the triangle choke into the rollover. And I just, they blew me away. They had great chemistry together. They set up really well at the top of this show for the Mark Henry versus Undertaker story moving on.
You mentioned there the finish of the match, and I find the triangle was just such an interesting kind of progression with the Undertaker's character, because when that was first introduced, I mean, it took a while for the crowd to be educated to this move, but it eventually culminated in a WrestleMania finish a few years later with Edge, and that became as over as any maneuver the Undertaker had. And it was really a great progression of building this move to this wrestling audience.
Here's an interesting little factoid. And it's something, you know, Court Bauer and Dave Lagana, who was running the show at that point, and I talked about sort of a lot behind the scenes. We always found, because, you know, when he came back as the American Badass, long before I came to the company, he, you know, and the Undertaker is a huge mixed martial arts fan. He trains jiu-jitsu. He loves it. We always found there was a bit of a cognitive disconnection between having the sort of dead man supernatural Undertaker character and trying to find the right balance between that and his working style as it progressed, a lot more sort of mixed martial arts involved in it. And one of the and this was one of the matches that really, really cemented the fact that The Undertaker is this very multidimensional character. But at that point, still sort of trying to find that balance was interesting. And I think it really was, you know, he progressed from the triangle, which he was using during sort of my time there, to the Go-Go Plata, which they branded as the Hell's Gate. And at the end of the day, yeah, once we get to both, I think, the work with Edge and the way he used the sort of both the sort of catch professional wrestling style and the mixed martial arts style in the wars with Batista, especially, I thought they really worked amazingly and completely fit the character by that time. But we were and Undertaker himself were still trying to figure out the right balance at that point.
It's always interesting with The Undertaker. I mean, he's probably the most successful gimmick this company has ever introduced. And for a lot of the times, I mean, his character really lent itself to fighting, you know, the monsters throughout the 90s. And it's really within this past 5 to 6 years that, you know, I think The Undertaker sometimes doesn't get his due in just terms of a top worker that we've gotten to see when he's in there with the likes of an Angle or a Michaels or a Hunter. And it's almost like these last couple of years have kind of reinforced that fact to people.
I really agree. I feel like The Undertaker is one of these guys who in sort of the late portion of his career. And I mean, look, I'm not a guy who takes, you know, any credit whatsoever for this. This all sort of happened after I left the company. I like to think that it started a little bit with the Angle program, but I think you hit the nail on the head. His work with Batista, his work with Edge, his work with Michaels, and even Hunter, who, as you know, I'm not the biggest fan of in the entire world. It's just, I don't know, you know, the Meltzer star system, I don't know about, but I'm certainly every year at WrestleMania, it's one of the matches I look forward the most to, because he is a master at creating really compelling drama with whoever his opponent is. And I think that's a huge credit to The Undertaker and his level of professionalism.
Alex, John and I both thought that the performance of Michael Cole and Taz in particular in this match was some of the best work that we've seen both of them do, especially contrasting with you know, the roles that they're given today. In your estimation, like what is the best use of Taz and Cole, and was any, you know, special direction given to him for these storylines?
I agree with you. I really love the chemistry with Cole and Taz, and I particularly liked it with JBL and Cole as well.
Yeah.
I feel like this was really sort of a very golden period, and I wish we could take some level of credit for that. But we always felt like Cole and Taz really sort of clicked as a team at the previous Survivor Series, at the Raw versus SmackDown Survivor Series in 2005. There was something about their chemistry in that match. And the only direction that we gave them and that Vince gave them was, you know, it was one of those rare instances that Vince was super high on the commentators, and they came back through the curtain on the night of that Survivor Series, and Vince gave them the big thumbs up, which Vince doesn't always give when you come back through the curtain, believe you me. And we said pretty clearly, we want more of that. And they just hit this chemistry that I think was all Taz and Cole just working together. They spent a lot of time in preparation for the events and for the matches and going over the run sheets and asking questions. And they came in really prepared. And I feel like they were really on their stride and on their game at that point. I mean, I can tell you when Taz went to go and do ECW, which was a smart decision and something that made a lot of obvious sense. We were really, really bummed because we felt like they were so on fire and in a lot of ways doing a much better job than at that point, not to take anything away from them, but then the team on Raw, because their chemistry was so good. You got the sense that these were two guys who liked each other. They weren't trapped in like a hardcore babyface or heel role. They went out there and called matches as though they were a shoot. They sold really great. They added to the drama of both this match and I think a whole lot of the work that was going on in this period.
I thought Taz was just so great at it. I mean, the pseudo mixed martial arts influence was something he could really sink his teeth into.
Yeah.
And with Michael Cole, I mean, traditionally when there was a big pay-per-view main event that he would call, there would always be the, oh, well, what if Jim Ross would have called that match? And it's really kind of unfair to Michael Cole that you have such a high standard with Jim Ross. I did not think that once during this match. I thought at the end of it, no, I thought this was a phenomenal job by Michael Cole calling this match, setting up WrestleMania. I thought this was one of the best performances I had seen from Michael Cole in his entire tenure. I thought that it was just a great match call from both guys.
Yeah, I absolutely think you're right. I mean, it's one of the things I did another interview a little while back with PW Torch, and it always comes up, you know, people say, It feels really bad to me. You know, Cole's a guy I like a lot and whose heel character I dislike a lot in the best possible way. But it's always felt to me like a waste of the guy's ability to turn him into such a hard heel character, to turn him into a character at all, really, because he is a good play-by-play guy. He's very solid. And yeah, it's tough to compare anyone to Jim Ross, who's, I think, one of the two greatest commentators I've ever heard with Soli when I was growing up. Cole gets a bad rap. And a lot of the bad rap is what he's getting fed through his ear from Vince and the character that they forced him into. Because, of course, it's really hard to have a guy trying to sell you a pay-per-view at one moment while he's also trying to get himself over as a heel character on the other. And it's unfortunate to me that was taken away from Michael in favor of trying to create a character.
Who were the key components of the SmackDown team at this point that you were working alongside?
It was David Lagana was the showrunner, Court Bauer, myself, Dusty Rhodes, and I honestly had Teddy DiBiase left the team at this point or not. I can't remember because he went to become an agent, a road agent, right around this period. We had both Dusty and Teddy on our team, and at some point right around this period is when Ted left to focus on agenting matches.
What was that dynamic like with the younger writers contrasted with, you know, DiBiase and Dusty? How did that dynamic work?
They were one of the things I really liked about the writing environment at WWE is there's always a sort of senior wrestler who really understands booking. And they were, at least to me, it was a massive help to have them around all the time because, you know, I'm one of the evil Hollywood writers who came in and I've got ego enough to know how to tell a story. But there is an appreciable difference between booking for professional wrestling and telling stories for episodic television. And had Dusty and Teddy not been there, whatever your listeners think I did well is due in no small measure to their influence on me. And many of the things that you probably think I didn't do very well are because I didn't listen to them enough. They were absolutely great. Now, of course, you know, there are things you agree with. There are things you disagree with, but their influence on whatever creativity I brought to the table was absolutely indispensable. And I think, you know, David and Court and Andrew Goldstein and all of the people who worked on the team during my time there would absolutely agree.
You mentioned that in terms of booking wrestling versus episodic television. Did you ever get the sense there was almost this internal identity crisis of what the company is? I mean, there's such a hard stance today about, you know, we are not wrestling. We don't even want that word used. Did you ever sense that? Because it seems that at the core of this, we are using our television to build pay-per-view, to build live events. But at the same time, I think they would rather much more be compared to just regular television programs and dramas and action adventure series, which they identify themselves as.
It is a constant tension that, based on what little birds tell me, still exists to this day. And you know, it's funny. I came in very much from the episodic television perspective, and Lord knows if Vince had given me free rein, you would have seen a lot more long, long stories with clues and breadcrumbs dropped, and it would have been more in the lost direction and less traditional professional wrestling left to my own devices. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is entirely an open question. But it is very much a tension that exists within the company, I think, to this day, because you have an episodic television audience who you want to keep on the hook next week, and you also want to do what wrestling television has been doing, as you said, since the 1950s, which is television is used to build live events and now to build toward pay-per-view. They are two different skill sets, and they're two sort of different mechanics. And it's not about – I think a lot of people misunderstand and think it's about – spiking a rating or that sort of thing. It really is, at the end of the day, the core of the business is still very much about getting money from pay-per-view and money from live events. That's where profit margins are earned. But the tension between are we creating an action adventure television program or are we booking is something that was very much an issue we dealt with when I was at the company, and it's something that they go back and forth with on each week, I would suspect, because you look at good episodes of Raw and bad episodes of Raw, and you break down what is it that I liked about this show and what is it that I didn't like about this show. And I think a lot of that comes down to the tension of the type of storytelling they're going with on a week-to-week basis. Part of that is the capriciousness of Vince, because I think some weeks he wants to create a drama for television, or a variety show, I guess, would be the way he would describe it for television. And some weeks he's concerned with building a professional wrestling promotion.
It was also on this pay-per-view that we saw the undefeated streak of Bobby Lashley come to an end. What was the decision behind ending the streak at this point against the person that he did lose to? And I wanted to get your thoughts on losing streak gimmicks in general.
It's an interesting
winning
question.
Streak gimmicks, sorry.
Or losing streak gimmicks have their place as well.
Yes.
I've been on one for much of my life. It's an interesting question. The streak coming to an end, we were just talking about Vince being capricious. The streak came to an end. As I remember it, the decision was made about 2 weeks before, and it really was as arbitrary as Vince walking into the SmackDown meeting and saying, I think it's time with Lashley. Because our original intention was to have both he and Kennedy undefeated going into WrestleMania, and that was going to be a match. That went by the wayside, and we ended up ending the streak with Lashley. So the call from on high was, we're going to end the streak at this pay-per-view and let Lashley work up from underneath. The decision to go with JBL for that was the idea that we went back and forth on it a great deal, but the notion of Ray winning at WrestleMania had been on the table for quite some time. And Vince's original notion was that we were going to continue the long, and I'm still very up in the air on whether it was a good thing, the comparisons between Ray and Eddie, and we're going to spend the summer in a long program with JBL and Ray that very much touched on the same sort of plot devices that JBL and Eddie had used a couple of years before. Of course, that sort of started but ended up not happening because obviously JBL got hurt and ended up becoming, I think, an amazing commentator during my run when I was the head writer that I'm super pleased with. Not that JBL got hurt, but that I had use of him as a commentator. And we wanted to begin an elevation of JBL because, if you'll remember, he'd been on quite a kind of a losing tear for quite some time at that
point. Yeah.
The cool story about this match is John was a big fan of Bobby and really wanted to get Bobby over and was frankly a little ambivalent about being the guy who took the streak away from him. But he wanted to, and I think until Bobby subsequently about a year later worked that mini program on TV with Chris Benoit, he who shall not be named. I think it was Bobby's best match. And there was this great moment before the match. JBL didn't want Bobby, because he was green, was very used to the matches really being laid out in some pretty significant detail before going in there. JBL was absolutely adamant. I'm going to give you a great match. Let's go out there and we'll call it while we're in the ring. You know, that JBL would call it while he was in the ring. So all of those great moments in the match, the series of four suplexes, all of those great things were, you know, Fit and John talked about it for a little bit. They knew what the finish was. And John went and called everything about that match in the ring. And I was incredibly proud of what both of those guys did out there. I thought it was a super entertaining match. It managed to end Bobby's streak and that storyline and the streak storyline in a way that I didn't think made Bobby look like a weak guy or in any way. And they did a great match. And then, you know, Bobby and Fit went on to work off and on all the way through the summer through the King's Court program and all of that in a way that I was pretty comfortable with. And it did a good job of elevating John.
And I thought at that time period, I mean, and throughout his run, Finlay was just such a quiet MVP because Lashley, instantly when this guy came into OVW was like, this guy has tons of upward potential, but he's really green right now. And he kind of fell victim to, I mean, he looked great. They put him onto television, I think, a little too early. And thankfully, you did have a guy like Finlay, who I think that's the smartest thing to do is just put this guy on the road with Finlay and work four nights a week with.
Yep. And that's absolutely what happened. And everybody was aware we were rushing him. I don't know if you remember, but during this period, we were sort of short on talent, particularly on SmackDown. And we brought him up from OVW and did this tryout match. Not tryout match. I mean, he was already in OVW. The crowd response when Bobby walked out the first time, and this is a crowd that had never seen him before. I can't remember what the town was, but for the tryout match, which obviously you tape them, the crowd response when he just walked through the curtain was like this hush and then this, oh shit, this guy's a star. It was apologies for cussing. It really, the crowd knocked him dead. And Vince that night was like, we're bringing this guy up. And Dave Lagana and Michael Hayes went back and forth in a terrific match of mental jujitsu, trying to figure out who would get him on which show. Because Hayes arguing, obviously, for Raw and Dave arguing for SmackDown. And we won the day. And I'm super happy with that because Bobby, I wish Bobby was still working on a regular basis, because I do think he's a guy with tremendous upside potential. In sort of one of the big picture stories I sold Vince on when I was just promoted as the head writer of SmackDown, he was going to be with Dave and Ray, sort of our three superheroes against just a wall of darkness was sort of one of our long range plans, because everybody believed he was absolutely going to get there and be a top level guy. But everybody was also aware he was rushed into it because we needed that kind of baby face. And thank God for Finlay, who I continue to think with Arn Anderson is one of the two best agents in the business. When Fit was an agent. And he did a ton for Bobby, from, you know, the gag turning over the car to giving him great matches week in, week out. It worked great. And John played a big part in that. I mean, this is sort of, I don't know how common the knowledge is, but Taz, JBL and Finlay worked constantly backstage with Bobby on his promos and things like that, way above and beyond the Call of Duty. Hayes did that as well. And I think if you just look just in the period that I was there, sort of that year and a half, at the incredible improvement that Lashley had, I think that's entirely the credit of a group of guys who really believed in him and worked with him really hard backstage.
Let's chat about the other major focal point of this pay-per-view, and that was the very, very controversial Randy Orton, Rey Mysterio program. I think it's an angle to this day that still leaves a sour taste amongst fans, you know, memories heading into this one. Let's just get your perspective, Alex, of kind of the genesis of this whole decision to incorporate Eddie, because I don't think many people had the problem of, you know, Rey, you know, dedicating this run to Eddie's memory, but it was the decision of some of the promos from Randy Orton that I think it was the wrong kind of heat, where it was like, I mean, myself at the time, I just felt like dirty as a wrestling fan supporting this. I just found it really exploitive at the time.
And you are not alone in that in any way whatsoever. Well, I mean, first, you know, I keep doing this mea culpa. I think we talked about it last time. One of the things my deepest regret from my time at WWE, and I'm the guy who deserves the blame as much as anyone. I was the head writer of SmackDown for a lot of Rey's run on top. I think we treated him really shoddily as champion. And I think we treated him really shoddily on his way to winning the championship. And this is a part of that. There was deep controversy inside the writer's room about the constant, some would say, exploitation of Eddie's legacy in such a way that I don't think it really got anyone over. I think most people had the same reaction you did. I think most people, including people backstage, didn't think that was the right thing to do. Vince's argument, and Vicky absolutely agreed with this, I talked to her about it point blank, was Eddie was a huge fan and would have approved of this. I can't obviously say whether that was true or not, and neither can Vince, who is making the argument. But certainly every week that these things came up, certainly everyone on the writers team, and I mean everyone on the writers team, said, are we sure we want to go here? And Randy felt like shit. He did not like doing this, and you know, he was younger and wasn't the star that he is today, and I think today would have vetoed it.
Yeah.
That's certainly my guess, because he told me personally how uncomfortable he was. You know, he was a good soldier, but if there's blame to be attributed, I think ultimately it goes to Vince, and you know, it comes to the question, at least after I came to power is the wrong word. After I got promoted and Dave moved to ECW, I think, you know, I'm one of the guys who has to take the blame. I could have fought harder, or I who knows what I could have done, but Vince was very adamant that's what he wanted. To go sort of deeper into the angle, I also think, you know, by giving him the Royal Rumble and then taking it away from him and then giving it back to him at SmackDown and all of that, that again, like I hate it that you guys and, you know, other interviews I've done, it always feels like it comes down to, oh, well, Vince is the boss. It's not my responsibility. And I hate being that guy. But I can tell you that in the room, we, you know, Vince went back and forth on whether he wanted Rey to win. Like we thought on the night of the Rumble, okay, it's a done deal. We wanted to couch him as a giant killer. And you know, Vince felt like, you know, you can't couch this guy that way. He's not big enough. You got to make him humble. You got to make him, you know, really, really fight from underneath for it. Goddamn. And went back and forth about whether he would win or whether he would even be in the WrestleMania main event a bunch. We didn't know that he was going to win until 3 days before WrestleMania. We were in Chicago at the point that Vince made the final call. And by that point, in fairness, so that all disclosure on the table, I at that point was in the, you know what, let's just run with Randy camp at that point, because I felt like we'd crippled him so much on the way to the WrestleMania match that I felt like it would be a waste of time. That's not the way we went, but I felt, you know, Randy stealing the Royal Rumble thing and then Rey getting it back, I felt like it was bad storytelling, and I felt like it was a really bad way to set Rey up to be a believable world heavyweight champion. And yeah, I mean, like, I know it sucks in terms of interview content, but I found it really disappointing. I just don't want people to think that it's in any way a reflection on Ray or Randy, who were being good soldiers and doing exactly what they were told to do.
What was it ever like after Ray won the Rumble? Was it ever decided upon that we're not going with Ray for the WrestleMania main event? We'll do something with him, or was he always penciled in at the very least to at least be in the title match at WrestleMania?
Oh, that's one of those, and I'm really not trying to make a hedge. I'm not 100%. I feel like he was penciled in at least. But I know there was at least some talk that from the higher ups that you know Vincent and Randy would be a great main. Oh, but we're taking something away from the fans if we don't give them Ray after he won the Rumble. So it was back and forth. But I think your instinct is correct. I think he was always at least penciled in to be in the main event. He was definitely. He was going to be the winner, and then he wasn't, and then he was, and then he wasn't, and then he was, and then he wasn't, and it went back and forth a bunch.
One of the other things that I wanted you to settle this, because I think you spoke about this on David Lagana's podcast. Tatanka was featured on this show as the mystery partner of Matt Hardy. Is there a story involving Tatanka approaching you guys with a floppy disk? With ideas for his character. I would love to hear this.
And not like an old school, you know, whatever they were, 3.5 inch, like a 5.5 inch floppy disk, like an old school computer, about all of his various ideas. And look, I feel like I knock Tatanka a lot, and I shouldn't, because, you know, he is on a shoot, a good guy who busts his ass to do what you tell him to do. And he's a talent who will come to you with ideas all day long on how to get his character over. You know, he came to us with the Tatanka Reborn thing that we shot in the subsequent summer after this show for a great deal of money, and had convinced Vince that he was going to be a top guy again. And then Vince pulled the plug on him before we could even really get rolling on it, which, you know, the stop start of talent is pretty frustrating. But yes, he absolutely brought us floppy disks. He brought us pieces of handwritten paper. He brought us all kinds of material. And the thing is, I don't want people to get the idea that means, oh, we were, you know, pissed off at him or anything like that. A lot of talent bring you ideas. MVP created MVP and everything he'd done completely on his own. That's an idea he pitched us that I had gotten a bunch of stuff from this guy. I ignored it. Court Bauer read it, and he's the guy who was like, MVP is ready to be a star. Bring this guy in now. And he was absolutely right about that. He and Dusty were the guys who realized the potential of a guy who I'm now, you know, I look at his work in Japan and I'm like, how is this guy not at the top in WWE because he's that freaking good. The Tatanka stuff, he brought us a lot of material, including stuff that I think was written on like a 286 IBM phone. I'm not sure. But I believe it was Court who ended up finding a way to get the disc read.
There were no ideas floating around of, you know, let's get a diva over with a farting gimmick. Was that ever, you know, tabled around?
Christ, man. Oh.
I find that to be one of the most embarrassing ideas, just for someone to pitch that idea, unless this is one of just Vince's deals. I don't know.
Do you remember the Dr. Heine sketch where they make fun of Jay?
Of course.
Yeah, I was the doctor in the mask who is assisting Dr. Heine in that sketch. I didn't want to be, by the way.
That's not on the resume, is it?
I didn't put that on my director's reel. But I am 98.6% certain that that idea was entirely generated by Vince for his own amusement. And it's a fucking crime because Natalya is one of the best women workers in the business. And I can't figure out why they haven't just run with Pin Up Strong, because, you know, she and Beth and now Karma's back in the mix. Like, what they do to women's wrestling particularly pisses me off, because seriously, dude, one of the angles I'm proudest of that I contributed to there was Mickey and Trish. and that whole story. And I know women can draw, and what they're doing, especially to Natty, is just preposterous.
Yeah, it's the kind of gimmick where it's like there's bad gimmicks and then there's like career killers. And that to me is what this one is. I mean, this is going to be to the average person. Well, that's the girl who farts. That's going to be what the first thing people think of. And it's terribly difficult to overcome.
It's ridiculous and insulting. And I can't even, except for the fact that, you know, Vince does a lot of shit just to amuse Vince. I can't for the life of me figure out why they would do that to someone as talented as Natalya is. And I don't want to take bread out of her pocket because I'm sure WWE pays her a shit ton more than there I am with the cussing again. I apologize, folks.
Oh, it's all good for Alex.
In a way that I would never want to take money out of someone's pocket, but boy, she would kill in Shimmer. She would kill in Pro Wrestling Eve. She would be, dude, she and Mickey working down in TNA would be tremendous. And they're just absolutely wasting someone extraordinarily talented. It's ridiculous.
We go to some questions from our audience at our Facebook group now, and Justin Rosero wants to ask, what was the decision behind putting the title on Angle at this time instead of perhaps an idea like putting the title up for grabs at the Rumble?
You know, that's a fantastic frickin' question, and I wish I could give you a definitive answer on it. I remember the night that decision was made. We knew Dave was hurt, and we knew we were going to have to take the title off him. We in the SmackDown writers room under Dave Lagana went back and forth, and we were pretty adamant that JBL would be a good guy to do that with. Use someone on our roster who is a proven commodity, who we knew could get baby faces over. It felt like the right thing to do to us. Vince went into business for himself, frankly, which is, you know, it's his company and his money. He can do whatever he wants. Like, you know, you say it's sometimes his decisions piss me off. A lot of times they did. But, you know, you can't argue with success. He's the man. He did a closed door meeting at some event. And all I remember is Dave walked in the room into the writer's room we have in every arena, which is basically a closet with some computers and an internet connection. And he pulled me and Court aside, and he said, we're going to do a battle royal tomorrow. It was a Raw show, and I guess Vince had some closed-door meeting, and then he called Dave in after the meeting, so Dave didn't even get a frickin' chance to volley whatever we wanted to do or to volley alternate ideas. Vince came in, and he told Court and I and you know, the other members of the SmackDown team, we're going to be doing a battle royal tomorrow night, and Kurt's going to go over and be our champion. And remember, this is after Kurt had been doing the sort of vaguely anti-American angle in the war with Cena, and we'd done everything we could to heal him because the Cena's had the problem even at that point that half the crowd booed him and half the crowd cheered him, and we knew strong heels were necessary to try and get the guy over as a babyface. Which I don't mean to be a reflection on Cena. It's just a problem that he's had for a problem or a bonus. If you look at last week's promo, that he's had for a long time. But that was news to us that we just ran with. But I don't know what the internals on the decision were. I do know that when Kurt came over, he was an absolute professional who busted his ass for us every single night and did everything he could to get and keep the title over.
How in terms of his health at the time, I mean, Kurt's a guy that always kind of downplays whatever problems are going on internally with him, just saying that he's good to go. I mean, were there any kind of signals to what would ultimately culminate with the whole showdown later that summer with Vince and him leaving the company?
Kurt was hurting a lot, dude. Like, and I mean, it's one of the reasons I respect him, and also one of the reasons I wish Vince and the industry as a whole, and I'm including TNA and the indies on this, were a little more adamant about letting guys take time off and healing instead of trying to, quote unquote, protect them in matches. You know, Kurt was hurting a lot. Like, I remember I had a long talk about a promo he was doing while he was laying on the floor with this sort of inflatable neck thing that sort of stretches out your neck. Because he was hurting all the time, but he's an absolutely monster tough son of a bitch. Who he downplays those things because, it's not a work that he won the Olympics on a broken freaking neck, as he's fond of saying in promos. And he's, you know, he's given a lot of his body to the business, and I just hope he doesn't turn into, you know, the Dynamite Kid where he's rolling around in a wheelchair, because I know for a fact Kurt works spectacularly good matches when he's hurting worse than when he's hurting to the degree that I wouldn't get out of the bed, you know. Kurt was hurting bad during our run. And as we talked about at the opening of the show, that match with Undertaker was a tough, hard-driving, physical match, and a lot of Kurt's matches were that way. On house shows, you know, he worked a lot hurt, and I both respect him and wish somebody higher in the power structure than me had said, this is ridiculous. You're hurting this guy who should have 15 more years in his career.
We're running out of time here, Alex, so we'll just go to one more question. Jason Greenhouse wants to ask if he says he's heard Dave Lagana talk about a lot of great road stories involving Dusty and Michael Hayes, and was wondering if you could share any of your own.
Oh, gosh. One of my favorite road stories is a road story through a glass darkly. I'm driving with Dusty, and I think it was Krista Joseph and maybe Dave was another of the guys in the car. And Dusty's a fantastic storyteller. I mean, I'm sure as a fan, you guys get that from his promos, but just sitting and shooting the breeze, he's the best storyteller in the world. And he tells this great story about back in the day, and I'm not sure when this was. This could have been mid to late 70s, I guess, in the Florida region. Mm-hmm. He and Captain Redneck Dick Murdoch are a team. And one night, I'm not sure whether they were actually a team or whether they were working against each other, but still drove together because they were buddies. And one night, Captain Redneck looks at Dusty and he's like, buddy, I know a party and we're going to go to it. And Dusty's like, you know, Dusty says, yes, sir. Yeah, that's where we're going to go. And they end up driving way, way out into the country. And Dusty's starting to get the Spidey sense going at this point. Dusty's like, buddy, I didn't know where we was going, but I knew it wasn't no place good. And all this drive, Dick Murdoch's telling him, oh, there's, you know, beautiful women going to be here. There's going to be plenty of beer to drink. It's going to be a good, good time. You're going to love it. You're going to make friends you're going to have for the rest of your life. And they're driving and driving and driving way out into the sticks. And Dusty notices over the next hill, it's hilly country. Dusty notices over the next hill, there's this bright light, sort of orange glow, like there's some sort of fire glowing. And Dusty's spider sense is really just screaming at him at this point. And they come around the bend, and sure enough, there's a bunch of people having a great old party around a burning cross.
Oh, Jesus.
Dusty realizes, holy shit, Dick Murdoch just took me to a Klan party.
Oh, my God.
And Dusty gets, to his credit, Dusty's not that kind of man at all. And Dusty gets infuriated. He reads Murdoch the Riot Act, and they end up leaving. And there's nothing really more to the story than that. But just the notion,
wow,
that he gets dragged to a freaking Klan rally, and he's just like, oh my God, what in the hell you think you're doing, dragging me here with these people? But that's in terms of road stories I heard when I was on the road, that trumps anything I could tell you. I got drunk at JBL's 40th birthday party and ended up getting sick. It's got nothing on that.
Wow. That's setting the bar pretty high there with the Klan rally. Alex, it's always a great time having you on. Definitely we will be pestering you to come back on the show at some point for sure. But as we end off here, give one last plug here for the Temple and where people can follow you online, because I know some of your wrestling analysis always fun to follow on Twitter.
Oh, thanks very much, man. Yeah, if folks want to follow me on Twitter, I tend to on Monday nights is my big Twitter night every week, because frankly, through Lagana and his I Want Wrestling hashtag, tweeting back and forth with friends and fans on Monday nights has become a big part of my wrestling experience. I just have a gas doing it. And you can follow me at Alex D. Greenfield. And as to the Temple, yeah, go to studios.amazon.com or to amazon.com and just plug in the Temple in the search bar. You'll find it. It's a motion comic, and I think you'll watch it and have a blast enjoying some comic book nerd violence. It'll be a good time.
And a cameo from
Alex from
Greenfield.
Me. I'm the first guy who dies. You'll get a kick out of it. If you're not a fan, you'll even get a bigger kick out of it, because I die horribly, horribly.
Oh, there's the hook for you, everyone. And we will attach a link to when we post up the show, and you can just be sent directly to check out the Temple. Very much appreciate your time, Alex, and kind of taking us behind the scenes here. It's always a fascinating time when we can review an event and then kind of see what was the decision-making process. So thank you very much. We really appreciate this.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, so a big thank you to Alex Greenfield for joining us. Once again, you can follow him on Twitter at Alex D. Greenfield. That was a lot of fun, kind of getting a behind-the-scenes look.
Totally. And Alex, thanks a lot. He's always very, very, willing to... Doesn't care about offending.
Gives us the straight goods.
Yeah.
That's what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now going to head into your feedback, where none of you guys hold it back either. And let's start off, Way, with... That's where you are supposed to just pop in.
Give me 1 second here.
Let's start here with Devin Clark. I remember watching SmackDown at the time, and I absolutely didn't like the Randy Orton angle with Eddie in hell. I thought it was absolutely disgusting. Why would WWE do an angle like this just 3 months after Eddie Guerrero died?
Kieran Roche, no matter how many years pass, the Eddie is in hell storyline is still one of the most distasteful storylines I've ever seen, and I just hope we don't have to see anything like that again in the future. But even though that was horrible, the main event of this show was absolutely fantastic. In my opinion, one of the best matches, if not even the best match of the WWE in 2006, a true classic between two legends.
It was a great main event. We've No Way Out, man, delivering some main events for us.
Do you think Taker will have a match of equal... or better quality than this one against Angle this year at WrestleMania?
I think him and Hunter will have a great match. I know some people are down on them going to the rematch, but I think in terms of just a match, I think it's going to be excellent.
Not for a second. Do I think he'll do any of the stunts with as much mobility as he did in this show? And that's
probably not. But Undertaker does. I mean. He does not typically hold back that much. I mean, he does some stuff that I'm just scratching my head that he is doing at this time. And you also got to figure, I mean, he's doing one match a year now. So it's not like this guy is necessarily preserving himself in terms of, well, I don't want to hurt myself here for whatever's coming up. I mean, this is his one match of the year, and it's kind of... doesn't worry so much about that cushion. But I think these two, I just think they have... fantastic chemistry together, and I expect another solid match this year at Mania. We go to Tenise. This pay-per-view confused and angered me all at the same time. Don't get me wrong, the in-ring work was good, especially the main event, which was awesome. I have no problem with Mysterio winning the Rumble and going to Mania, but to tease the fans and viewers that he lost his chance by losing to Orton confused the hell out of me. It tells others and myself that winning the Rumble doesn't mean a damn. Also, how they positioned Rey on being one of the stars of the company at that time by exploiting Eddie Guerrero's death made me sick. It blows my mind that those who were close to Eddie, such as Benoit, Rey, Chavo, and others, let this go on. At this time, I was ashamed and embarrassed to being a wrestling fan. I really wondered, do I want to continue on watching WWE on wrestling in general? And thanks us for our podcast. You know, it's you know, it's a tough spot. I don't want to, you know, throw criticism at these guys who are being told this is what we are planning and you are doing your job, especially as we mentioned with Alex, that this seemed to be something that Vince was pushing hard. And, you know, today maybe some guys would have vetoed it. I don't know. Mick Foley was very critical of it and wrote a blog on WWE.com even where he talked about his dislike for this angle at the time. And it led to Mick Foley getting, you know, some internally some people were not happy with that.
Richard Elsie, I remember the build-up to this show and the eventual rage at watching Orton take Mysterio's spot away. Even with two world titles at this point, the Rumble managed to carry a lot more weight back then, more so than what we're used to right now. As for what was deemed tasteful concerning the Eddie in Hell angle, I've always looked at it from two sides. Initially, I was repulsed by it, less because of the content and more because it summed up Orton's inability to garner heat that wasn't cheap. Eddie's body was barely... Oh, boy. Eddie... Here we are using his death as a means of piling heat on a guy I found boring even then. On the other hand, I thought of Eddie's sense of humor, the impact he had on the locker room, and the association the WWE had already begun to build with Vicky. To think that the WWE would have gone about this without any kind of blessing or approval from those who mattered to Eddie would be a reach. And as we heard from Alex, Vicky agreed with all this, and, you know, everybody was just doing their job.
Okay, we move on to... Where are we going here? Tom Ketwig. The only reason why people might be interested in this show is for the Kurt Angle Undertaker match, which I really enjoyed. It was probably my favorite Taker match. Oh, and I was never a fan of the things they did to Eddie's name after he passed away. Just wondering what it was like doing the brand-only pay-per-views. Did people in the company like doing them since they could build guys up longer, for example? I thought that the SmackDown... only pay-per-view, especially for February, I enjoyed. I enjoyed the fact that, especially in a year where you might have a Raw guy win the Rumble, and then the SmackDown pay-per-view can be focused on determining who will be challenging for the SmackDown title. And in that way, it was a bit effective. Whereas now, you got to keep the champions occupied. And, I mean, I've gone on about how I'm not a fan of how they handle these February pay-per-views.
Well, what do they do this year with the SmackDown winner coming... the Rumble winner being from SmackDown and a SmackDown pay-per-view in February. How did they handle the Raw side?
You mean how they would have done it this year, for instance?
No, I mean 2006. Because you're saying how it would be effective if he put his
Mania spot on the line. I wasn't opposed to Ray putting the spot up against Randy Orton.
No, I'm just saying. I'm saying that. This year, the February pay-per-view and the Rumble went to a SmackDown guy.
Yes.
So, does that take away from the Raw side of things and the build-up for Mania?
I guess, so to speak. But you got to pick the one guy that you're going to focus on for the Rumble. Who's your hot guy that you want going into Mania with that momentum? And, you know, every year they've got to pick a side that wins the Rumble. And every year they're going to have to pick one where, you know, it is going to get less of an emphasis, so to speak, at that time of the year.
Finally, to David Warden, a really strong show. Angle Taker was awesome, with Angle making Taker look like a shoot submission specialist, and some sweet and innovative MMA-inspired sequences. The rest of the card was pretty strong, too, and I was reminded how good the Benoit Booker series was back in 06, although it's scary watching Chris take some of those bumps. A 7 out of 10, and if Kurt has any sense, he'll watch this and realize wrestling forgettable match after match on TNA is not what he should be doing at this point in his career. Why not have him come back to the WWE with an MMA-style gimmick and just have him wrestle once every 2 months? He could have four-star matches a year and elevate up-and-comers like Ziggler in the process.
I don't think that will be happening. That's so against the WWE's mindset, and I don't think they're interested in Kurt Angle at this point. I mean, his contract was up, and he resigned. And you've got to imagine that he at least tested the waters to see if there was interest in the WWE to go back for one last run. But he's getting up there in age, and I don't know if I don't think you will see Kurt ever go back to the WWE at this point, at least in a wrestling capacity. So that will wrap up our look at No Way Out 2006. And I want to thank all of you for your feedback at reviewaway.com. We do this show every Wednesday in addition to our other shows, Review a Raw Monday night, and Friday we have Review an Impact, which this week we will be joined by Nate Milton and UK star Mark Haskins. to discuss the recent TNA tour of the UK and his match with Austin Aries.
Mm-hmm. Mark Haskins. A lot of you are probably wondering about his status after that botched Shooting Stars press and then the subsequent, vicious
finish to the match.
Yeah. So we'll get an update from Mark and hope you guys look forward to that.
So next week, Wei, what are we going to be discussing?
Well, I'd like to talk about a new company that, that's been getting a bit of attention, and that is Rinka King. That is TNA's, I guess you would call it a spin-off promotion.
Yeah.
That's catered towards the Indian market, and it features a lot of current TNA talent, and it's always available online and also on Colors in both America and Canada. So I'd like to sample the new product and, you know, talk about it.
So we are going to review this coming weekend's episodes, which are episodes 5 and 6. They air on Colors TV in Canada, at least on Rogers, at 8 p.m. Eastern, Saturday and Sunday nights. And just go online, youtube.com/ColorsTV. There's lots of people posting the shows up there, so not a very tough show to find. And one of our Royal Rumble contest winners, Sajid, is going to join us by phone. We are going to have him on the show. I thought he was a local listener. He lives in the U.S.,
okay.
So we can't fly him in. It's not part of the deal. So Sajid will join us to cash in his money in the podcast or whatever he's got, his review away briefcase. He will be joining us next week to chat Rinka King. So once again, episodes 5 and 6. A big thank you to Alex Greenfield for joining us. That was a fun chat to have. And you can follow him on Twitter at Alex D. Greenfield. That is all for us. And I guess we got to go out with some music here, Wei. So I found this cover song that I want you to hear. I know you're a big fan of covers.
Mm-hmm.
So check this one out. Have you ever heard this?
Your time is up, my time is now. You can't see me, my time is now. It's the franchise, boy, I'm shining now. You can't see me, my time is now. Just if you don't feel it. Still hard not to show up. You got money stacked there. Can't really slow up. Franchise, one piece, and this is a song I have no reason. The song is a soldier. And I think for your life. I'm throwing all up like I'm thunder and lightning. When you can wave your kick, I'm hard and nails. Screaming all up like I'm thunder and nails. Tone scales, competition. Look at the home rock wishing they could be in my division, but they gone fishing. The whole way, shut the boy whole way. I got my soul straight. I bet you melt like Colgate. And everywhere they will dance, dance, someone so hot. Never let us pan, dance, dance, sweat, and they hate, let them hate. I'll drop your whole plan. Get down for 3 seconds, pan.